Good evening, America. Welcome to the program. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. How's everyone doing?
Doing good.
Great, thank you.
Our program phone number for dial-ins, if our listeners would like to call in and participate, is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. As usual, we want to give a disclaimer, and that is that we are not attorneys, and the Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. Please contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. And also, the opinions expressed by the callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. But as always, thank you for taking time to spend with us as we dive into the different subjects of judicial injustice. This evening, we have a very interesting program. We're going to do a little bit of reflection on a program that we had earlier in the week. But we're going to have one of our special guests, Lisa Bloom, who is an attorney as well as a legal analyst and journalist. And her, those who watch court TV and that type of thing, they'll be familiar with that name. Also, we have a couple of other guests coming on, Lawrence Severance. And then for our profile of the wrongfully convicted, we're going to have Ron Kine. And so we look forward to having all those guests join us as we launch our program this evening. Okay, now, Ethel, a lot of times we, and those who are used to listening to the program, know that we talk a lot about the IRP 6.
Yes.
That is initially the basis for this program because of the wrongful conviction and all the gross injustice that has occurred in this case.
Absolutely.
Now, the IRP 6, and we'll talk a little bit more about it as we reflect on a previous program, but for right now, we do want to at least raise the issue that the IRP 6 case is about six IT executives who have been wrongfully convicted, have been wrongfully incarcerated now for over 21 months. They had a company, IRP Solutions, doing business with the federal government, building software called the Case Investigative Lifecycle Software. It was a software that would allow federal, state, and local law enforcement to collaborate on investigations. And the company executives were accused of wrongdoing. In 2005, the company was raided by the FBI. Basically, you have a debt collection case that got criminalized.
Exactly.
The case went to trial in 2011, and that's where the wheels fell off the wagon, so to speak. You got a wrongful conviction. You got several points that are under appeal, one of which being a Fifth Amendment violation. And the transcript pertaining to that Fifth Amendment violation is not being released by Judge Christine Arguello. And the court reporter in that case is Darlene Martinez. So we have a lawsuit that is currently underway. And then also we have a petition that's out there where we're asking people to sign to compel the Department of Justice or the federal government, basically, to release those over 200 pages of transcript. That petition can be found at change.org. Again, change.org. Do a search on IRP 6, and that will come up. We ask that you would sign that petition. Call your friends. Ask them to sign it. We ask you to sign it as you're listening to the program tonight.
Absolutely.
Ethel, what else are we asking folks to do?
And, you know, while you're calling your friends and asking your friends to sign the petition, we're asking you to make a phone call and ask your friends to make that call as well to Attorney General Eric Holder's office. His number is 202-514-2003. And 2005, and ask him why hasn't he done something about this over 200 pages of missing transcript in the IRP 6 case. We need some traction on that. These men have been sitting in prison now for over 21 months, and he has done absolutely nothing to remedy this situation.
Absolutely. And if you like more information about the IRP 6 case, we ask that you go to freetheirp6.org. Again, freetheirp6.org. All of the court documents that you would ever want to read about this case are out there. And so we invite you to read the material. Come to the conclusion for yourself.
Absolutely.
I mean, there was a lot of strange things that happened in this case, a lot of strange things still happening. And when you have folks, everyone that hears the details about it, they say, man, that is bizarre, or I've never, ever heard of that, or whatever the case may be. The IRP6 are Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, and Demetrius Harper. And we ask that you would keep them in your prayers. Also, if you'd like more information about A Just Cause, you can go to www.a-justcause.com. And also, we're trying to build our donor base. So there is a donations button on that page, and we ask that you would help us out. There are also a lot of helpful resources there. For programming information about A Just Cause Radio, go to ajcradio.com. And then for 24/7 programming, you can go to live365.com. As of April 20th, that's a Sunday, we will be joining the PRN.FM family. And so every Sunday, you'll be able to catch a broadcast of the of A Just Cause Coast to Coast from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's where Cliff, Ethel, and I will be part of the Progressive Radio Network. And so that's just another option for you to catch up on a little bit of programming. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Cliff, let's put that word out there as far as the jurors are concerned.
Yes, the jurors in IRP 6 case. We want to let you know that we understand that the conclusion you came to was because of what you were told by Judge Christine Arguello. Frankly, she lied to you. She did not give you all the evidence that you asked for. She did not let you hear all the witnesses that should have been allowed. She did not allow all the evidence that the defendants wanted to present. That left you in a situation where you had to make a decision with only what was in your hand. So we want you to understand that it's not you who we blame. We blame Judge Christine Arguello, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, for the atrocities that they committed during the trial. So if you have questions about what happened, about anything that happened after the trial, about evidence that you did not see, you can reach out to us. We will give you everything that we have. Like Sam said, you know, what we have is out there on the internet. Only thing we don't have is that 200 pages of missing transcript.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
If you want to reach out to us, we ask you that you call us at 855-529-4252. Again, that's 855-529-4252. Or you can contact us at contact@a-justcause.com.
All right. So for our listeners who have been listening for a while, you know what that sound means. And that's a segment that we started not too long ago. It's called Things That Make You Go, Hmm. So, Cliff, you have a very interesting one. I mean, you know, it's a serious note, but at the same time, it just kind of shows how the media gets slanted.
Yes, and I caught wind of this. This is a local station, KRDO News, Channel 13 in our own beloved Colorado Springs, Colorado. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the same, you know, let's just get into it. There is a group. They are called Mothers of Murdered Youth, the MOMY. We take nothing from them, take nothing from their pain or the fact that they are trying to bring some exposure to the facts that their children are being murdered, and we feel for them.
Right.
And we don't belittle that at all.
Mm-hmm.
On Friday, April 11th, last Friday, they had a rally. 12 of the participants from Mothers of Murdered Youth, you know, took it upon themselves to go in front of the district attorney's office in downtown Colorado Springs and say, hey, we want to ensure that you bring some type of exposure to what happens to our kids.
Mm-hmm.
This was on the evening news. Nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely.
At all.
Mm-hmm.
I commend the evening news for bringing attention to their plight.
Yeah.
With that being said, you have 12 participants of a group. They came out. They made it on the evening news with their rally. They were out there with their signs and everything. A Just Cause, and I had them pull these numbers up for me, and it was kind of astonishing, also embarrassing for the city, Colorado Springs, state of Colorado's media in a whole. We did three rallies at the federal courthouse in downtown Denver. This is A Just Cause. Three demonstrations out there with pickets, 100 people at least, bullhorns.
Yeah.
Middle of the day, letting everybody know, hey, this is what we're here for. This is who we're protesting. Three of those at the Denver Federal Courthouse. We did a demonstration at the Denver Detention Center. That comes up to four so far.
Yep.
We
yep.
went in front of U.S. Senator Bennett's office. That's five.
Yep.
We went in front of ABC News. That's six.
Yes.
We went in front of CBS News. That's seven.
Yes.
We went in front of the Women's Hall of Fame protesting Judge Christine Arguello being inducted. That is eight protests that I just called.
Now, Cliff, let me ask you a question. Yeah. For the listeners who may not know, so I'm asking you this question on behalf of the listeners.
Yeah, on behalf of the listeners.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Stewart, you're telling me that your group –
yes.
I'm interviewing you now.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So you're telling me that your group protested in front of CBS News.
Yes.
NBC News. Mm-hmm. And was there another news station? Well, let's just go with that.
Yeah.
CBS and NBC.
At least those two.
Uh-huh.
And you're telling me that the news station did not bring a camera out in front of their station.
Not only
to ask, you know, what are y'all doing?
What are you guys doing? Not only did that news station not come up, but not even the rival news station. Now, ABC is across the street from Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you would have thought Fox would say, hey, there's some people over there rallying. They got bullhorns and signs. Let's go put that on the news. Like, hey, what's going on over here?
Exactly.
That didn't happen. But we're talking about eight protests with at least 100 participants,
right,
bullhorns and signs, and protesting the wrongful conviction of the innocent.
Exactly.
And you're telling me this can't get on the news? Out of eight times, I could see it was like, okay, once, oh, we missed them.
Right.
They left before we got there.
Mm-hmm.
Eight times, but you can bring up when there's 12 participants,
okay,
in front of the DA's office. Now, we're in front of the U.S. Senator Michael Bennett's office.
Now,
Cliff,
in front of his
office. You're talking about eight protests that lasted at least 2 hours.
At least two hours each.
I think one of those in front of the federal building was like half a day.
Exactly.
Half a day.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were out there.
It was in the summer.
The heat of the summer.
And there was at least 2 hours.
And they would not pick it up. And what you have to also look at is that not only did the Colorado Springs News pick up the 12 participants in front of the district attorney's office,
right,
that's the city DA,
right,
they also put on the news when Spotter the Otter ran away from the zoo and
wow.
was gone for 2 weeks. That was headline news, but you're telling me that a minority-owned business could be
right.
could be raided
mm-hmm.
by 21 armed FBI agents, four FBI vans out in front of the building that says FBI, 21 agents with jackets on that say FBI. That couldn't get picked up by the
this is like in a corporate
yeah, a corporate building.
Hey,
you got a
yeah.
bank on one floor.
Yeah.
IRP Solutions is on another floor, and you're like, everybody knew what was going on. No news cameras,
yeah.
But you call that fair
reporting. You know.
And Cliff, on that, I want to make a point that, you know, some listeners may say, well, why would you want the news to cover the fact that you're being raided by the FBI?
Mm.
Well, the point is, and the point
Make
always
plain.
Has
Make
been
mm-hmm.
that IRP. The point is that IRP was doing nothing wrong.
Absolutely.
The executives of IRP were doing nothing wrong.
Nothing.
So if you are not doing anything wrong, you want to draw attention
exactly.
to yourself.
Welcome it. That's
now,
right.
if you're guilty and you got some guilty, some criminal enterprise going on, then, you know, you're going to run. You're going to
mm-hmm.
be like crawl under a rock.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't want to be out there. But when you try to get in front of the news and try to get your story out there,
mm-hmm.
and they shut you down.
They shut you
so
down.
For those listeners who are trying to figure out, well, why are they talking about that? Because of the fact that when you're innocent, you want to get your story out. Why won't anyone help you get your
exactly.
story out?
Yeah.
And you know the old saying says you can't buy this or that. You know, you can't buy a clue. Oh,
mm-hmm.
oh, I couldn't buy some heat in the middle of summer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Just Cause, the IRP6, couldn't buy media attention. And
exactly.
that's not just a saying.
That's true.
When
no,
we
that
said,
is true.
When we said
yes,
we
is.
Will pay
yeah.
to put an ad in some of the papers, the Washington
that's
Post,
right.
the New York Times.
The Chicago.
No, yeah,
yeah.
The Chicago.
LA Times. Yeah, all of them.
No, we can't do that. We can't let you pay to put an advertisement in about the injustice that's
yeah.
going on. How is it you can't even buy
okay.
some media attention?
The managing editors, man, they, as soon as they hit their desk, it's like, oh no, we
like,
can't.
No.
We can't
exactly.
do it. It's like
it makes you.
What's controversial about someone's trying to prove their innocence?
Exactly, and it's not like we're out here with a bunch of our opinion. We say here's all of the evidence, every piece of paperwork, every piece of file transcript. except the 200 missing pages.
That's it.
All of it that we have, we readily give it to you. But no, that's too controversial.
That's too,
we can't have.
And unlike other news organizations, we are going to talk about other news stories. We're going to share other stories.
Yeah, we're going to tell you how.
So you know, so we, for those listeners again who may be naysayers or whatever and say, well, you know, all they're doing is pushing. No, we're not just pushing one side of any particular story. We give you all of the different angles of the injustice that's going on in the land with regard to the judiciary process. So let's do that right now. We're going to go to another news story. And
share some
information about some things that's going on.
And you know what? And let's go with this one that I found here. This is out of New York, and it's talking about the Shellhammer abruptly out as Attorney General's conviction review bureau chief. His sudden departure follows his recommendation to free a gentleman named Ronald Bauer. Okay. This gentleman, Thomas Shellhammer, like I said, he was the chief of the Conviction Review Bureau. He has left his position. Nobody wants to say anything. Nobody's telling why he left. When he calls, forwarding his calls to his old office, but they won't say why this man has left. And what they're saying here is that he has left his position because he believes that this Mr. Ronald Bauer, who has been in prison for over 23 years, was wrongly convicted. And he has, he says that this man spent 23 years in prison for heinous crimes, sex crimes, an ever-growing number of law enforcement officials believe he did not commit.
Wow.
And he has a lot of supporters, you know, who are seeking also to reverse this conviction. And he's talking about different people, even people from law enforcement who actually had arrested and charged him with this crime, do not believe that this man is guilty of committing this sex crimes. And they're saying the independent team of investigators concluded and produced a mountain of evidentiary documents to prove that Bauer is innocent, believing the real perpetrator is likely to, check it out, a former New York City police officer.
Mm, yeah, so they threatened him out.
You know, I mean, this is like, are you kidding me, though? Are you kidding?
And you know, I'm looking at a little bit of this, and I guess on the night that happened,
mm-hmm.
the police allowed the police officer who they think did it change out of his hooded sweatshirt.
Yes.
Yeah, and because put on a suit and tie. But the bad thing, now they said the kids that said that that this happened to them said the guy had on an orange hoodie. They made Bauer
put on
an orange hoodie and take a mugshot.
Exactly.
Now, how do you do that?
I mean,
then take the guy who did it.
Yeah.
Who they know did it, be like, get him out of his street clothes and put him in a suit and tie and take a mugshot. Who gets a mugshot in a suit and tie?
Man.
That is some crazy
stuff.
So
if you like more information on that one, you can find information at www.longislandpress.com. Longislandpress.com and that talks about Shellhammer being the Attorney General's office and resigning there. We have one more that we're going to touch on real quick here, and this is also in New York in Kings County, where the guy who recently left office, Hines,
mm-hmm.
and he admits that misconduct was part of a high-profile case.
Yeah, this one is sickening. I mean, it. And what always gets me is that as soon as they leave office, then,
I
have all this information.
Right.
If you were really about justice, why didn't you say something when you were in the position to make a difference?
That's right.
Say, okay, I've resigned.
Yeah.
I've retired.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finished now. Now, oh, guess what? Yeah, they were killing people downstairs in the police department. Why didn't you say something in the time
sucked.
That it was
Are
happening?
Are you kidding me?
And this guy, Jabbar Collins, was convicted, and Hines all along felt that he didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the investigator, the prosecutor, right in his office, Michael Vicioni, Collins didn't do anything to reprimand Vigiani either.
Mm-mm.
And he felt that the things that were done in this case were totally out of line and that Jabbar Collins didn't do any wrong. There is something wrong when you have, like
totally.
You said, Cliff, you know, when you have people that are in office
mm-hmm.
and know that a case got prosecuted,
mm-hmm.
yet they did nothing about it. I mean, he knows
years.
That Vigiani
yeah.
threatened witnesses,
mm-hmm.
withheld exculpatory evidence
mm-hmm.
in order to win the case against Collins.
Exactly.
And but this man spent 16 years, but
yeah.
what happens to Hines?
Exactly.
Now that he's retired,
he's out. Yeah.
he's going to live a cushy little life. They need to go and lock him up. For
and
Vigiani
as well.
And judges are saying that, you know, basically the prosecution of Collins is shameful and horrific.
Yeah.
And the fact that Hines failed to do anything
mm-hmm.
is disturbing and puzzling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we hear those kind of adjectives now all the time.
I'm telling you.
I mean, because the system is corrupt. And it's almost like there are not enough words in the dictionary to describe some of the stuff that's going
on. That's so true. That is very true.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in a few minutes. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our number this evening, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Government targeted, prosecuted, convicted, six executives in, held back evidence,
come on.
Hundreds of pages of Mr. Manuscript, court circuit, 10th district denying the writ of mandamus, free the RP6, critical
yeah.
rights violations, scandalous, their motivation to finish their business
yeah.
with, major companies, the government, legal PD, test potential customers,
come on.
Faith attempt to obtain funds from banks and angel investors with no success, like calm, melt down, finance, skeptics, so they hire staff and come to fill the gap
yeah.
with every attention to fulfill the contract,
yeah.
fill the deal, when money come back, everybody paid the bills, the wages, take care of all
come
of
on.
That, no Friday, they got viable software,
uh-huh.
but you compare them to those with nothing to offer,
right.
prosecuted by the attorney's office,
right.
before the FBI gotta start
yeah.
investigating charges, skipping steps
ooh.
In the process.
Right.
Even boring, the testimony of Andrew Alvarez,
a
witness who could tell why any staffing company
right.
that could do a dumb rash street credit check would stick out their neck
uh-huh.
if there was no prospect they could collect when they're reeling the net. It all relates to Harvey Silver's late statements about the vagueness of federal law, new district chaos, A_JustCause. Read at rp6.org.
Yeah.
47-205-9620 just blog. It's just us, but we don't gotta just talk. We can just walk to the courts for the cause with one voice. It's just free them all.
Come on.
Thank you.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Ethel Lopez and Cliff Stewart. Our number this evening, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Also want to remind you that we have a petition out on change.org. Please go out there. We would appreciate your support for the IRP6 as we try and petition the courts. Not try, but we are petitioning
Absolutely.
The courts to get over 200 pages of missing transcript.
Yes.
If you'd like more information about the IRP6 case, go to freetheirp6.org. Freetheirp6.org.
Absolutely. And you know what, guys? I'm looking at another article here, and we're going to go through this real quick. It's written by Edwin Grimsley. He's a case analyst with the Innocence Project, and this is titled "African American Wrongful Convictions Today." He had done, I guess, previously a part for Black History Month, and he wrote about five historical cases of African Americans wrongly convicted in the Jim Crow era. And so he follows up with this one, talking about how contemporary wrongful convictions compare, you know. And so he's looking at here the majority, which is 63% of those exonerated through DNA evidence are African Americans. That's a large 63%.
Wow.
And then it says that the presumption of innocence for African Americans throughout the criminal process is still hard won. Why, though? Why? And then he starts talking about, you know, how some of the reasons is because of racial bias, harassment in poor neighborhoods and things like that. The pressure they're under leads to a cycle of criminal arrest and so forth. Then he goes on to talk about, you know, the different people and what took place in their cases, like Thomas McGowan. He had a prior police contact before a minor traffic, which was a minor traffic violation. And his mugshot from his arrest was entered into a police photo lineup, and he was wrongly identified by a victim as having committed some kind of heinous crime. You know, this is it's ridiculous, because what he's saying is these juveniles, these black people are already in the system, you
yep.
know. So they keep going, pulling them through the system and pulling them through the system. And so when somebody is pulled in for a crime of murder and stuff like that, who else is it going to be except a black person or Latino that's already been in the system? He points out about, you know, these Central Park Five, you know, after 14 to 30 hours of interrogation without lawyers present, deprived of sleep, four or five defendants offered inconsistent confessions as to the crime location and their respective roles in this rape, you know. And after that many hours of interrogation, you know, sometimes I look at Cliff and he's half asleep, and the stuff that he's talking about, you know, while he's half asleep. And these guys are under pressure. You're talking in a serious situation, though. But this is totally ridiculous. This is totally ridiculous.
Well, and Ethel, you know, to that point, we already know
yeah.
that the lifetime likelihood of imprisonment, and I'm actually reading this off of the Sentencing Project.
Right, right.
But other folks have done studies on this, and the numbers are consistent across the board.
Yes.
As far as African Americans are concerned, one in three will go to jail. I mean, and you know, we've often talked about it from the standpoint of there's some baby being born out
mm-hmm,
there,
mm-hmm.
and or let's go to a maternity ward somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and there are three little, cute little African American male babies.
Yeah.
One out of those three may as well just go on and take them to jail right now.
Yeah. That's it. I mean, and when you bring it, you know, you really bring it home and you say, okay, me, you know, I came from a family of 12. I got four brothers, seven sisters.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at least one of my brothers, just because of the fact that he was born.
Well, he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. He.
Your brother
yeah,
is.
And my brother is in prison.
Yeah. Wrongly.
For no reason, because he was born black.
Absolutely.
And he's sitting in prison, wrongfully convicted. I mean, it shows the proof of that step.
Yeah.
Here's Clint yeah. Stewart sitting in prison, never been anything but an upstanding citizen his whole life, tried to follow after a dream to help his country, patriotic in every way, spent almost 15 years in the military, And how does he get repaid by his country?
Now,
by being in prison for no reason.
And look at another one of the IRP6, David Banks.
Yep.
Yeah.
One out of three sons.
No. Two out of three.
Yeah, two out of three. Him and his brother.
Absolutely.
Wrongfully convicted.
Wrongfully convicted.
Yes.
And so, I mean, that's one of the things that you find that it's almost like one of those hard things to drive home to people that this is real.
Yeah, it is.
And because we live it every day, it is something that, you know, it's a serious reality.
Mm-hmm.
But you get tired of the thing of you know, people don't engage, people don't get involved because it has not hit them yet.
Right.
Exactly.
If you're black, you got a 1 in 3 chance that you're getting ready to get
home.
Hit.
That's right.
It's coming home to you.
That's exactly right.
And I mean, what you say when, you know, people don't get engaged with it because it's like until it happens to them. I tell my sons, I'm like, a lot of times he's like, he'll say, oh, I'm hungry, I'm starving. And I'm like, you have never been hungry in your entire life, ever.
Exactly.
Because he'll say, I'm hungry, I'm starving, like for breakfast, I need something to eat. Why don't you go in there and fix you a bowl of oatmeal? Oh, no, I don't want oatmeal.
Mm-hmm.
I say, you're not hungry.
Exactly.
And so just like you say, Sam, people will say, well, you know, that's maybe that may have been some years ago. That can't be real because, you know, I got two brothers, and none of us have gone to prison.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're coming to get one of you guys.
Oh.
That's what we're trying to bring home to you, that unless you get into the fight, unless you get into the press, they are coming to get you. And just one other point that I wanted to make on this article, they said, you know, most of the time, mostly everybody who's getting out is on a DNA exoneration.
Yeah.
And but he lays out that there was Tim Cole of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
He died 13 years into his sentence before DNA showed that he was innocent.
Yes.
There was another man, Frank Lee Smith. He was serving 14 years. He died of cancer in 2000, 11 months before the DNA testing was approved.
Mm.
These are men who are dying in prison who never belonged there in the first place.
So
we got to fight for our brothers.
But you know what? We got the best justice system in the world.
That's what they
you
say.
Know? So, hey.
Hey, but there are a lot of people that are working to bring attention to it. And
that's it.
A just cause is part of that fight. And then also people like Lisa Bloom, who is an attorney and an author, an NBC legal analyst. And, you know, folks are familiar with that name. Lisa has a new book out. It's called The Inside Story of One of the Most High-Profile Cases in This Country, The Inside Story of the Trayvon Martin Injustice and Why We Continue to Repeat It, Suspicion Nation. Ms. Bloom, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, I stated, I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with you, have seen you on television. And whether it's been, you know, CNN, CBS, or Headline News, Court TV, you come from a long line of programming, if you will, from a legal perspective. So as far as the Trayvon Martin story, what led you to write this book?
So I wrote my book, Suspicion Nation, because I covered this story gavel to gavel for NBC News and MSNBC. And as I did, I became very disturbed. I saw a case that was going off the rails. The evidence was going in one direction, and the prosecution was going in a different direction. This is the first time of my 20 years as a legal analyst covering every high-profile case in America, and in my 28 years practicing law, that I had seen this kind of thing, that I had seen a prosecutor not arguing his best evidence, not putting together just a normal closing argument that would give the jurors a roadmap to conviction. Witnesses seemed to be unprepared, expert witnesses who weren't called, who obviously should have been. So when the case was over, I had this feeling in my gut that something was very wrong about this case, but a gut feeling was not good enough for me. I wanted to know the facts, so I did my own investigation. I interviewed witnesses, attorneys. I dug through the evidence. I found people involved in the case who had not been put on the stand. And the results are my book, Suspicion Nation. And I have to tell you, I was even more disgusted after I did this investigation than beforehand. Everything that a lot of us suspected is true and then some. I mean, the prosecutors, frankly, just did not do their job. They did a very incompetent job. And so the first half of my book are the top 6 mistakes that they made, many rookie mistakes that you would not expect seasoned prosecutors to make. missing the best evidence in the case, not putting together the arguments they should have, not preparing witnesses like Rachel Gentel, whose story I tell in the book. And then the second half of the book is about the bigger issues, why we continue to see cases like this, because it's not just the Trayvon Martin case. We see this over and over again in America, and each time we're shocked and appalled, and we should be shocked, but we should also look at the root causes so that we can stop these deaths of unarmed African-American young people from happening.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the Dunn case, the same thing.
Yep.
And it's as if the racial imbalance in this nation, people have failed to look at a life is a life is a life, regardless of the color of the person whose life is taken, or regardless of who is on trial. A lot of times,
that's, you know, such an important point. Yeah, exactly. And you know, one of the things Rachel Gentel says in my book, when I asked her about Trayvon, what she wants us to know about him, she said he wasn't an animal. You know, as if this is the very low bar that we have to get over. We just have to acknowledge that he was a human being. I mean, it's so disturbing to me that we still have so far to go, and that those words were echoed by the prosecutor in their closing argument when they talked about Rachel, and they said, she's a human being. You know, she's a lot more than a human being. She's actually a very bright young woman with an important story to tell, but a story that didn't come across at the trial. Why? Because the prosecutors didn't prepare her. She was just a nervous teenager. She could have easily been prepared, but they didn't do the job.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that, you know, that statement that you have to convince the country that this person is a human. That should be that is the first part of, you know.
Yeah, why does a statement like that have to be?
I mean, it's like you can't even get words out about it. That is the given.
Yeah.
For them to have to say, okay, remember that this person is a human, just, you know, look past, is basically what they're saying is look past the fact that they're a black human and remember that they're a human. It should not have to be. It reminds me of the movie A Time to Kill, when Matthew McConaughey had the whole jury close their eyes and then had to say, now imagine her as a white girl. It's like,
yeah.
Why?
That's right.
What's the
exactly. And it reminds me of those famous signs from the civil rights era. I am a man, you know,
yes.
So brutal in their simplicity. But this has been the struggle of the civil rights movement for many, many years. And, you know, someone said just before I came on that our criminal justice system is the best in the world. Well, you know, I would take issue with that. I mean, we have the highest rate of incarceration of any country on earth, not just any developed country or any Western country, of any country on earth or in human history. How can we say we have the best system when we incarcerate 2.5 million of our own people?
That's right.
And Lisa, I was going to say, that was a joke. We've been talking about that for a while.
Well, then I got you. Then you're being sarcastic. Okay, good. I'm sorry. Well, I take it back, and we're all on the same page.
But you know what, Lisa? the fact that you could make the statement that you take issue with it speaks volumes to who you are. Because so many times we have people who don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. Like, well, you know, it's still good. Just like Attorney General Eric Holder said. Well, it's broken. It needs to be fixed. It doesn't work, but it's still good. How do you put those two things? That is an oxymoron in its purest form. You cannot say that all these negative things about it and then say it's positive at the same time. It does not make sense. And I was thinking about one of the statements that you said during the Trayvon Martin case, where they didn't even call expert witnesses that should have been called. And looking at, you know, our flagship case at A Just Cause is the IRP6 case with six IT executives. And in their case, the expert witness was called and the judge pulled him off the stand. And you say, how do you come up with a way to pull a witness off the stand, an expert witness at that, unless
you can, unless you can disprove his credentials. And it makes no sense. It speaks to the fact, just like you're saying, that the system is so twisted, it is so just backwards, and judges let prosecutors run amok. And then what happens is the judges and the prosecutors come together to convict who they will and let who they will free. And it the system is broke. It needs to be demolished.
And one of the problems we have is that prosecutors have way too much power. So I devote a chapter in my book, Suspicion Nation, to this problem. Because if you and I are involved in a criminal incident, they can decide not to prosecute me, but to prosecute you. And there's nothing that anybody can do about that. And let me tell you, since I'm white, and I'm assuming you're African-American, they are going to decide to prosecute you and not to prosecute me, because there's so much racial injustice in our system that is really the root problem. And so I really wanted to drill down on that issue in the book. I mean, let's stare it down. Let's talk about what the real issue here is. Trayvon Martin, in a very real sense, was put on trial, and Trayvon Martin did not get a fair trial. Why do prosecutors forget how to prosecute when they have an African-American victim, or when they have police officers who are in the defendant's chair? You know, this is what we see over and over again. The prosecutor, the lead prosecutor in the Trayvon Martin case, claims to have won 80 out of 81 of his prior cases. So he was a guy who knew how to prosecute. Why did he make so many rookie mistakes in this case? I mean, I'll give you one quick example, if I may. George Zimmerman demonstrated on a videotape taken the day after the shooting where his gun was holstered. It was holstered inside the waistband of his pants, behind him, over his rear end. Why is that important? Because he says he was down on his back. Trayvon Martin was straddling him, knees to elbows, when Trayvon supposedly saw the gun, reached for the gun, and threatened to kill him. And that's when Zimmerman says he had to pull the gun and shoot in self-defense. Well, unless Trayvon Martin had X-ray vision, there is no way he could see through the bulk of Zimmerman's body to a gun holstered behind him. And when you add, it was a very dark night, it was raining, there was grass on the ground, it was a matte black gun with a matte black holster, it's just not possible that Trayvon Martin could have seen the gun. But the prosecutors never argued that.
Wow, that's amazing.
And when you look at it, and see, you know, a lot of people say we come up with conspiracy theories, but when you look at the evidence, see, they bother us because we look at the evidence and then we call it for what it is.
What it is.
That scenario that you just laid out says the prosecutor did not bring that issue up. So let's ask, why did the prosecutor not bring that issue up? Because he did not want George Zimmerman convicted. Is there any other reason that he would have left that key material situation out of the trial? What else do you come up? What else is a conclusion? Unless you say, okay, did you want George Zimmerman prosecuted? Did you want him convicted? Did you want the truth to come out about what happened that night? You have to say, no, obviously, and evidently you did not.
This is what I call the blow it or throw it question. Did they intentionally throw the case, or did they just blow the case? We know that right after the not guilty decision, the lead prosecutor, Angela Corey, looked right into the cameras with a big smile on her face and said, "The system worked." And she said, "We did our job. We put all of the evidence out there so that America could see and make its own decision." Well, I'm sorry, but that's not actually what her job was. She's not a documentary filmmaker or a journalist who just puts a bunch of stuff out there and then people can take a look. Her job, her team's job, is to connect the law to the evidence and give the jurors a roadmap to conviction. And we now know, this is the first chapter of my book, Suspicion Nation, it's inside the jury room during deliberations. We now know that four out of the six of them wanted to convict George Zimmerman when they went into deliberations, which is amazing considering how bad a job the prosecutors did. But they got the basic idea, Trayvon Martin, unarmed, walking down the street, George Zimmerman jumping to conclusions about him in that very first police call, which was recorded, and then Trayvon winds up dead. And Zimmerman's story is self-defense, and there's a lot of problems with that story. Okay, so the jurors got that basic, you know, framework of the case, but they struggled in deliberations because they didn't have the facts and the law to support it, because the prosecution didn't give it to them, because the prosecution basically just asked questions in closing argument. So, you know, people can read my book and come to their own conclusion about whether the prosecution blew it or threw it.
Right.
You know, the outcome is terrible either way. Either they just didn't care, and they put all the evidence out there in a very haphazard, you know, novice kind of manner, or they did intentionally throw it because they wanted to vindicate their own police force who didn't arrest Zimmerman for 45 days, even though they knew that he was a shooter right away because he was standing there with the gun when the police pulled up. Mm. Either way, it's an outrage.
So, Lisa, can you tell us a little bit about Juror 6?
Juror 6. You mean Maddie?
Yes.
So, yes, the one who's a Puerto Rican / African American?
Yes, yes.
Okay, that's Maddie. So Maddie, yeah, she's the only one who has actually given a name. I only use her first name in respect for her wishes to, you know, keep her full name private.
Right.
And I opened the book Suspicion Nation with Maddie's story because it's a story we have not heard before, and it's very disturbing. So Maddie tells a story, frankly, of racial profiling inside the jury room. There were 6 jurors, all women, 5 white women, and Maddie.
Right.
And from day one, Maddie was demeaned and belittled. They made fun of her. They made fun of how she talks. She was called ghetto. She was the only one who had a sheriff's deputy stationed outside of her hotel room door.
Wow.
And when she saw that, you know, she had to ask, well, you know, is this just because of my skin color, or is this just, you know, I'm at the end of the hallway, maybe that's where this person gets stationed? I mean, it's just that uncomfortable feeling that so many people of color have. You don't, you know, you have to wonder, am I being profiled, or is this just a coincidence? But there was nothing to wonder about in terms of the way that they were treating her, all that demeaning and belittling. And I tell those stories in the first chapter of my book. And Maddie felt like she was unimportant, that she didn't have a voice. She had a hard time, you know, standing up for herself. And by the time deliberations came around, 3.5 weeks into the sequestration, she was just felt very worn down. And, you know, this is very consistent with what we know about tokenism. There's a lot of psychological research when you're the only person of color in a group, or you're the only woman, or the only gay person. You know, it can be very, very exhausting being the only one. If there's 2 or more, there's a big difference, right? So anyway, Maddie felt that George Zimmerman was guilty of murder. She was exhausted by the time deliberations came around, and ultimately, you know, was convinced by the very strong voices for acquittal to vote for acquittal. But ultimately, you know, I don't blame her. I blame the professionals in the courtroom who failed to do their job.
Right.
If the prosecutors had given them the evidence and handed it to them, had put together a timeline, had put together, you know, the story of what happened, had given the theory of the case, as they do in any other case, I think this case would have been very winnable for the state of Florida against George Zimmerman.
Yeah. So, Lisa, how much time do you have with us? I know.
Just another couple of minutes. Sorry.
Okay. No worries. Yeah, we got another guest we're going to bring on here in a moment. We were going to engage him in this conversation, but we don't want to infringe upon your time. So we'll bring him on after we release you from the line. So, Lisa, as far as your book is concerned, where can folks find it, and where can they get more information about, you know, the different things that you're involved in right now?
Well, thank you. So the book is called Suspicion Nation. It's available everywhere books are sold, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I encourage people to go to their local independent bookstore, especially African-American bookstores. I'm doing my tour all over the country. Mostly at African-American bookstores, but all at indie bookstores, because I think we all need to support them. I have an event at Marcus Books in Oakland, California, this Saturday at 5 p.m. It's a free event. It's the Bay Area's oldest African-American bookstore, so I encourage everybody to come out there. It's a really great place. And my website is lisabloom.com. On Twitter, I'm Lisa Bloom. On Facebook, I'm Lisa Bloom. Do you sense the theme? But I do love to hear from people on Facebook and Twitter, especially people who are reading my book. I love to hear their thoughts as they're going along.
Well, Lisa, we're going to have you back again and talk a little bit more about this subject, as well as, you know, just the racial disparity in our judicial system. And when you made that comment about the studies that have been done on being the only minority or only woman or only whatever in a particular group, you know, I kind of chuckled to the side of my mic because, you know, we live in Colorado. I was kind of surprised when you said, I assume you're African-American. But at the same time, you made that comment about being the only one. I mean, we live in Colorado, and I believe the percentage is something like 5% African-American. And in the IT world, Cliff and I both work in that world. And when you said being the only one, believe me, that's our life every day.
Absolutely.
Every
it's
day.
Tough, you know, right? Yeah.
Well, you know what? I don't let it faze me.
Yeah,
I mean, it's life. And if people have a problem with me as an African American male in the business world, that's their problem. It's not mine.
Well,
that's their problem.
Good. That's a very healthy attitude. But I think those of us who are in the majority, racially speaking or what have you, should be sensitive to that, though, and understand that it's not easy to be the only one of, you know, a different color or different gender or what have you. I just think it's something that we should all keep in mind. And, you know, the second half of my book is a lot about racial disparities in the criminal justice system, which I know is of interest to you folks. So hope you get a chance to take a look, and I would love to read everybody's thoughts.
All right.
Yeah, and you know, that case that we're talking about, the IRP6 case, stay on the line. Let Olivia give you some links to some of the documentation. I think you would find that as a nail biter, you know, as far as writing a book about it. There are some things in there that you think this has to be a movie. This did not happen in real life.
Exactly.
So we appreciate you coming on, Lisa. Take a look at it and see what you think. And like Sam said, we'll have to get you on again and talk to you some more about this stuff. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, everybody. Have a great day.
All right. That's Lisa Bloom, author, attorney, legal analyst. Her new book, Suspicion Nation, the inside story of the Trayvon Martin injustice and why we continue to repeat it. Again, that's Lisa Bloom. You want to check out that book and check out all of her sites, and we'll have those posted on our website. Again, thanks to Lisa Bloom for joining. Next on the line, Cliff, let's bring in Lawrence Severance. Lawrence is an attorney, and Lisa talked a little bit about the jury situation in the Trayvon Martin case. And so Lawrence has a study out, if you will, that he's done. And it talks about criminal jury instructions that juries can understand. I mean, the whole judicial system needs to be revamped. Yeah. But when it comes to jury instructions, man, that's like a big gaping hole that you can drive a truck through that needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
And when we know firsthand how it applies and how it impacted the IRP6 case to where we have to talk about it, and Cliff has the every show, mm-hmm. you know, that, you know, if you were on the IRP6 jury, we know that that there were some things that happened that that if you want to make it right, reach out to us. But anyway, let's bring Lawrence on. Lawrence, welcome to the program, sir.
Hello, this is Larry Severance.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to be on the program tonight.
So is it okay to call you Larry?
Yes, please.
All right. That's just like Samuel versus Sam, you know?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much.
So, Larry, tell us about your background, and then let's get into, you know, your study on jury instructions and some of the things that you're working on with regard to that.
All right. Well, I'll give you a brief background because it creates a bit of a context for the work I did on jury instructions. I was interested as an undergraduate in psychology and ended up pursuing a doctorate in social psychology, which I got from Duke University. And I then got a teaching job in upstate New York at a place called Skidmore College. And Skidmore College had an extension program called University Without Walls. And it was offering inmates in a maximum security prison in up the Thruway, a little north of Saratoga, the opportunity to earn college credit while they were doing time. And Then there was a structured program that would allow them to plug into the college when they got out. And these were people that weren't under life sentences, so they were going to get out. And they were people who were screened for their ability to be able to do college-level work. And I signed up to go into the prison and teach social psychology. And I got into there. There was a class of about 20 people. And I had one white person in the class. I had four Latinos, and everyone else was African-American or black. And as a social psychologist, just looking at that class composition, I said, you know, crime isn't distributed quite this way on the outside, so what's going on here? And I became interested in the concept of discretion and how discretion gets exercised in making calls. Whether to arrest a person, the police exercise discretion. What to prosecute them, how, whether to charge with a felony or a misdemeanor, the prosecutors exercise discretion. The judges exercise discretion in sentencing. And what you see in a prison is the accumulation of all that discretion that got exercised in society. So I became very interested in the criminal justice system from a social psychology perspective. And eventually I took a leave of absence from the teaching job, moved out to Seattle and attended a year of law school at the University of Washington, and then decided I was going to complete law school. So I did that. And while I was going through law school, I taught evening classes in social psychology at the University of Washington, and then was fortunate to link up with a very well-known cognitive psychologist, Elizabeth Loftus, whose most famous work is in the area of eyewitness testimony. And she and I wrote a grant that got funded by the National Science Foundation to study the problems that lay people have understanding jury instructions. By the time I started that work, I had graduated from law school and became a public defender, so I was a half-time research faculty at the University of Washington and a half-time public defender. And so that's just to reflect my own, which side of the aisle my experience is on in terms of the criminal justice system. The work we did was to start with pattern jury instructions. And for listeners who may not be familiar with that term, The judges in each case are obligated to instruct the jury on the law at the conclusion of the evidence. And the task of a jury is to decide facts that are in dispute, decide what set of facts are most probably true, and then apply the law to those facts and then decide the case in that way. And that's what the general jury instructions tell jurors they should do. Well, as one of your recent guests pointed out, it was a federal judge who was on, the jury instructions are a subject for appeal. And in any case where there's one side or the other, where the defendant, let's say, is convicted and feels there was an error of law in instructing the jury, that's the basis for an appeal. And
Absolutely.
Over time, appellate courts have ruled on what is or isn't a correct statement of the law. And as you might suspect, the rulings have resulted in more and more convoluted jury instructions that are the correct statement of the law, and more confusion for the average layperson who's not used to a lot of legalese and is confronted with what are often run-on sentences and very abstract ways of expressing the law. So our work, we decided to focus on the criminal domain as opposed to the civil domain. And in each case that involves an alleged crime, the state is required to prove not only certain acts occurred, but also that there was a certain mental state associated with those acts. And the mental states that the state or the people have to prove in a criminal case vary with what the definition of the crime is. But the four key ones are intent. You can have a crime that you have to prove intent. The next mental state that's slightly less culpability or seriousness is called knowledge. That's where you are basically finding that a person knew that if they have certain facts and if they went forward, that would probably constitute a crime. There's recklessness, and then there's criminal negligence. So those form sort of a hierarchy of mental states: intent, knowledge, recklessness, and negligence.
Now, Larry, let me have you hold that thought there just for a moment. And so when we come back, we got to take a quick break. And
sure.
Come back. I want to come back to those points, and we want to dive in and just kind of, you know, talk a little bit about the IRP jury situation. And it sounds like you've listened in or did a little bit of study on some of the guests that we've had on. But on that point of intent, we definitely want to come back and talk about that. So if you'd hold that thought, I'd appreciate it. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. On the phones with us this evening is Larry Severance, and we're talking about jury instructions and how jury instructions can be compiled to where juries can understand it. But we do know that that is a problem in the land. Our number this evening, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
You are listening to
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. Joining us on the phone is Larry Severance. Our phone number this evening, if you'd like to jump in and join in on the conversation, is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. There were 4 points, Cliff, that Larry was talking about before the break with regard to jury instructions, and he was talking about intent, knowledge, recklessness, and criminal negligence.
Right.
And you know, those are some things that we were talking about on the program the other evening. So, again, want to welcome Larry to the program. Larry, we're going to play a clip from our program on Tuesday evening, and that's where we had a retired district judge, a federal judge, Sarakin, H. Lee Sarakin, and he is a retired federal judge as well as retired appellate judge. Mm-hmm. And then there is attorney Darren Cavanocchi from California. And so we had them on the program, and we were talking about the 200 pages, over 200 pages of transcript that's missing, and just some of the process kind of stuff. And that was one of the programs, I think, that you were making reference to. So if we can go to that clip real quick, and then we're going to get some comments on that, Larry, and then we'll talk about some of those things as well.
All right.
Inconceivable to me in this day and age in the federal court, particularly in Colorado, by the way, which I think has sort of advanced when it comes to computers, that they don't have an alternate way to maintain the record. And the fact that the court reporter doesn't have it or hasn't typed it up, as everybody says, is inconceivable. So this record exists somewhere,
yes.
And for some reason they're resisting producing it, I think is a fair inference. Darren, can I call you that?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard the earlier part, but what the claim is that the defendants, in effect, were told by the judge, and I don't know whether it was just in connection with scheduling, but they claim that he compelled them to testify. They didn't have any other witnesses, and she said something to the effect, well, then one of you will have to take the stand. Now, that might have been said, or unless you do, the case is over because you don't have any other witnesses. But they inferred from that that the judge was take the stand. And that's why that particular segment of the testimony of the transcript is so important, because if that weren't the contention and there's something missing, appellate court is liable to say, well, unless there's some prejudicial error involved, what difference does it make? But this is so critical that that's why they want it, and that's what the big fuss is about, and legitimately so.
Wow. Well, now that's an interesting piece, and I didn't quite connect the dots on that, because I had seen reference that there was this Fifth Amendment violation, and of course, potential Fifth Amendment violation. And it sounds like that missing chunk of transcript would help us decide the issue. What's so shocking to me is that the role, my take on it, and Judge, I'm interested to hear if you disagree, but the role of the judge and of what I would call the entire operating system of the court is to ensure that justice is administered fairly. And if you will, it's the judge, the court reporter, the bailiff, the clerks. They're there not to advocate for one side or another, but to make sure that the work product that is produced is fair. And trials are a lot of fun for the lawyers that get up there and make all the arguments. But as fun as they may be, you never want to have to do them twice. And that's why judges are there to protect the record. That's why appellate lawyers are pouring through those records to look for anything that renders that trial as fundamentally unfair. There's enough about the system that, at least from the defendant's point of view, smacks of unfairness as they go through the process. And I see these kinds of issues surface all the time. And so the one objective piece of evidence, which is the transcript, for that to be missing only would feed concerns and conspiracy theorists alike. And frankly, that's a very disconcerting notion, that it's this one critical piece above all other pieces that would be missing. I think there's a reasonable inference that can be drawn there that the missing piece would therefore be favorable to the defense, or at least that's what I'd be up there arguing.
Yeah, so listening to that, Larry, you know, we listened to to Judge Sarakin. We also listened to Mr. Kavanoki, and they're basically just laying it down, you know, from their experience, from what they've seen, and to go to the jury on this, you know, the jury never heard the intent of, like, in the IRP6 situation. The jury never heard the intent, and I'm sorry, this is Cliff, by the way.
All right,
but
thanks.
The jury never got to hear about, you know, that instruction on listen to the intent of what the defendants were doing while they were conducting business. And one of the defendants of the IRP6, David Banks, he explicitly asked the judge, I would like to put that prong into the jury instructions that says our intent as businessmen were to market our product, were to sell the product, and then our intent was to pay back our debtors, because this is a debt collection case that the prosecutor criminalized and then threw a spin on and ended up with these men convicted. And you have where their intent was not allowed to be seen. When you look at their knowledge of what they were doing as far as businessmen, it's like, what we're doing as businessmen is business as usual. So their knowledge of what they were doing, nowhere was it in their mind that, hey, this could constitute some type of crime. And another piece of this puzzle is that the judge would not let the expert witness, Andrew Alborelli, testify to the fact that what they were doing and what their knowledge of what they were doing, that was the way that business was done in the industry that they worked in. When Andrew Alborelli, who was the expert witness, got up on the stand, the prosecutor objected, the judge pulled him down, and how do you pull down an expert witness unless their credentials are disqualified is beyond me. But anyway, she pulls him down. That's one of the things that's up on appeal. So the jury never got to hear that the way that these men were conducting business was business as usual. They never got to hear that their intent as businessmen, that they had to, that the government had to disprove their intent to sell their product and to market their product and then to pay back their debtors. So you have all of these missing pieces to the puzzle, and then you expect the jury to make
And Cliff, if I can interject there as well, on the thing with the expert witness on Andrew Alberelli, and Larry, since we're talking about juries, you know, when Andrew Alberelli took the stand, that was in the presence of the jury.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden this man is being dismissed. The jury was never informed as to who this guy was, why was he on the stand, and why was he abruptly stopped from talking and dismissed?
Right, exactly.
I think that's a problem in itself, that occurred in front of the jury. Normally, if there's a question about an expert qualifying to give testimony or the subject matter of the testimony, there's a preliminary hearing, or at least a hearing, an offer of proof outside the hearing of the jury, where the judge can then make a ruling whether under the applicable law the testimony should be admitted or not. But to do that right in front of the jury amounts, in my view, to a comment on the evidence, and judges in their impartiality are not supposed to comment on the evidence. That's a basis for appeal. So,
right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they're not supposed to make a comment on the evidence or the viability of a witness. I mean, this judge just basically discredited this witness in front of the jury, which is outside the realms of what she is supposed to do. And
absolutely,
you have her, you know, like you said, not only doing this, but in the presence of the jury and never coming back and giving the jury an explanation of what went on. And when you look at how the prosecutor was saying, well, I guess maybe you don't know, but the prosecutor said Andrew Alberelli didn't come forward early enough to be an expert witness. In essence, he sent a letter to the U.S. Attorney's office 90 days prior to the trial to basically say who he was, his credentials, everything about him and what he intended to say about the defendants and the way they did business. He was also on the witness list. I mean, obviously, a person cannot get up on the stand unless they're on the witness list. I mean, it would otherwise, how do you even get in the courtroom? How do they say we're going to call our witness? They got the list. If your name's not on there, the judge says, hey, this man's name's not even on the list.
Right.
You can't call him as a witness. But that's a side note. So he gets up on the stand. And then, like you say, in the presence of the jury, he's taken down this whole big to-do about who he is and why he's on the stand, happens in front of the jury, and then, you know, it's like suddenly it gets sucked up like it was in a vacuum, and the jury's sitting there like, what happened? Who is this man? And like you say, you know, now the judge has, in essence, in the mind of the law, mm-hmm. commented on the evidence, mm-hmm. and also on the viability of the witness in front of the jury, but then expects them to make a viable decision. And I was looking in your book, and I looked at this case with Mr. Marin, and you were making the point about, you know, 4 days after the conviction that the judge had to come back and overturn the jury's verdict because the prosecutor never discredited the other reasons why this man would have done what he had did, and it so aligns to the IRP6 case because they're saying, okay, well, if the jury came to a conclusion about what happened, but you know what else could have happened. And he never discredits it, and then he comes back. They come back with a guilty verdict. And in this case, gratefully, this judge, you know, had a sense of being a mind to say, you know what, you guys just broke the law, and I cannot uphold this verdict because the prosecutor is a buffoon, and I got to throw it out. So it's
right. Basically, it was a circumstantial evidence case, and the judge found that was not a sufficient enough basis to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So That's where the judge is supposed to exercise impartiality, and did so.
Yes.
And another question, Larry. I was curious, too, because with the instructions that were given, you know, after the trial was over and everything, to the jurors on the IRP 6 case, and the judge, you know, told them in the courtroom how, you know, they could talk to anybody they wanted to talk to, you know, and so forth after the case was over and everything. But then she followed them into the jury room and gave them total different instructions as to not talk to anybody on the defense team and you know, don't speak to any of the, you know, the defendants, don't speak to their lawyers, don't speak to any of these people. Would that not be considered?
Was that after the verdict was reached?
Yes.
Yes.
Now, is that not considered jury tampering? And if it is, what can be done about that?
I don't think I would go as far as to call it jury tampering. In the jurisdiction I practice in, jurors are not obligated to talk to anybody about what went on in the jury room. Nor are they prevented if they choose to talk to somebody about what went on in the jury room. And oftentimes, attorneys will be present when the jury's dismissed and will ask to engage them in a conversation about what occurred. Sometimes it's a teaching moment to learn why a person didn't do as well as they expected in a case, but other times it can uncover reasoning, and sometimes that's helpful if one side or the other is looking to identify issues that might be a reason to overturn a decision. Okay. So, I've actually served on a jury, and the judges, in my experience, haven't pushed you not to talk to one side or the other. They just force, let's say, it's up to you if you want to talk or don't want to talk. So I'm very surprised if there was actually that kind of statement made, but I don't think it amounts to jury tampering if it occurred after the verdict was rendered. So the jurors were being excused because they'd finished their job, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but in circumstances, you can ask if it doesn't reflect some bias on the part of the judge to give some sort of direction to not talk to one side of the case, but feel free on the other. I mean, that does reflect a bias, I think.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, yes. But anyway, what I was going to say, even you know, to after that and to the same point, you know, some of the people, you know, some of us had spoken with, you know, some of the members of a Just Cause organization had spoken with some of the jurors. And these people, you know, one of them in particular, they was frightened out of his mind because he's saying that, you know, oh, I can't talk to y'all. I can't talk to y'all. We were told by the judge and by the bailiff not to talk to any of y'all, you know, and if you did, you know that we're supposed to call the prosecutor and let him know, and then he was going to send the FBI agent out, you know, and he wanted us to get your name and information on whoever it is that contacted us. And they actually did send someone to this man's home.
I don't have a clue why that would be the case. Something very odd was going on there.
Absolutely.
Outside of my experience.
Absolutely, something very odd going on there, Larry, and that's the whole thing. I mean, that's why we bring attention to those
absolutely
kind of things, because
absolutely
of the fact that is so out of the norm. When the judge Christine Arguello in open court,
yeah,
tells the jury, and like you said, it's the disposition as far as, you know, being relieved from their duty and say thank you very much, and you know, you get a chance to go back to your normal life. But then she says, but if you don't mind, and you know, it's kind of like one of those saying, if you don't mind, but at the same time saying, you know, go in the jury room, I'll be in there
right,
in a second.
Right, exactly.
And I will be in the jury room to speak with you. And then you have another private conversation in the jury room. And then after that, the jurors are lock-lipped. I mean, so it wasn't just a, you are free to talk to whomever you want to, if you want to. It was more of the don't talk to anybody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I could speculate that perhaps the judge saw some problems in the way the case was handled from the bench and didn't really want the light of inquiry to focus on what those possible issues were.
She was the problem. She was the problem. The judge.
Well, from what I heard in the clip concerning the Fifth Amendment issue, yeah, it sounds like that, because that would be tantamount to in telling a defendant they either take the stand or they're done. Well, you have a right to remain silent if you're a defendant in a criminal proceeding. So basically, there is a Fifth Amendment question there, and I don't know if it had occurred to the judge, but that could have been a question that people would want to ask jurors. Well, how did that affect you?
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, Larry, I got one more quick question for you, and then I know you have to go.
All right.
Does the judge have any obligation in a scenario like this? I'm going to point it to you. In the IRP 6 case, the IRP 6, when they were questioning the prosecution witnesses, the prosecution called all these folks who were supposedly had, these allegations and trying to formulate, why they felt that the IRP 6 had done something wrong. The IRP 6 impeached, I would say 98% of them.
Yes.
If not 100%. I mean, I'm not going to, I don't have the numbers in front of me exactly how many of them, but almost every single prosecution witness were impeached. Now, when you read the transcripts, the judge kind of glosses over that, and she doesn't even, even in the jury instructions, she doesn't give the jury any indication as to what that means.
What impeachment means?
Yeah. And so you have the defense, the IRP 6 impeached the prosecution witnesses, prosecution witnesses who were accusing the IRP 6 of committing crimes. But the IRP 6 impeached them, but the judge did not, make it clear to the jury what that meant. Now, when we talk about jury instructions and how the jury can get it right and how they can understand, do you think that a judge should at least kind of explain what that means?
Well, yes, I do. There's a typical general instruction given in our jurisdiction, which basically says that the jury has to decide, what weight to be given to the testimony of each witness. And essentially, when you have a jury trial, it's because there's facts in dispute, and the jury is going to decide those facts. And credibility is always an issue, meaning is a witness perceived as truthful or not truthful? And it's the job of one, in the adversary system, one party has the right and the duty to ask the penetrating questions that can impeach a witness. But in the end, the jury has to go into the closed door, behind the closed door, and weigh that evidence and decide individually and in its entirety what it all means. So the typical instruction about impeachment, there's sometimes instructions that say, don't worry about any rulings I've made. If one lawyer makes a statement and another lawyer objects, don't worry about those, the judge will say. And the judge will say, basically, it's the jury's job to decide credibility issues. So they may not use the word in process of the trial itself, and point and counterpoint is supposed to be the factual basis for deciding on the, they call it veracity or the truthfulness of the witness.
And, Larry, I would actually have to point back to that clip that we played from Judge Sherrickin and Darren Kavanoki, where, the comment was made that, the judge and the court reporter and the bailiff and all the members of the officers of the court, so to speak, at that level, they're not there to advocate for one side or the other, but it's the judge's role to protect the record. It's the judge's role to ensure that fairness is executed. And so, like the example that we gave with the expert witness, where, just abruptly dismissing the expert witness, well, obviously, that's going to put a cloud of doubt over that situation, as you described earlier, And then with the impeachment side, again, that's not going to give any favors to the defense side. So this whole thing was slanted, you know, right throughout the entire process.
Yeah.
So at any rate, Larry, how can people get more information about you and get in contact with you if they like to, you know, pick your brain a little bit more on how to make
My email address is the best way to reach me, and that's ljseverance, S-E-V-E-R-A-N-C-E, at msn.com.
Okay, awesome. And we will post that as well. And so, Larry, we really appreciate you taking time out and giving us a little bit of insight into your work with regard to jury instructions that juries can understand, and allowing us to kind of bounce some ideas off of you and share some of the points related to the IRP 6 case. But if you got
thank you very much for inviting me to be on the program tonight.
All right.
Thank you
very much. That's Larry Severance. Again, we appreciate Larry joining us this evening. All right, Cliff, let's go to the phone. I believe we have our guest on that for our profiles of the wrongfully convicted. We have Ron Kine on, and Ron is currently the Assistant Director of Communications and Training for Witness to Innocence. And so, you know, any situation where there is a wrongful conviction and an exoneration, and in Ron's case, having spent time on death row. I mean, that's none of these stories are starting to make any sense. I mean, story after story after story is baffling, but at any rate, we're going to let Ron share a little bit of his story with us. Ron, welcome to the program, sir.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. I was a little concerned earlier. I heard somebody make a statement that this is the best justice system in the world. I almost fell out of my chair. We have half of the people in our prison systems in the United States have never hurt anybody. They didn't steal anybody's stuff or anything. They didn't damage anything. They got high or they helped somebody else get high. Our system is rampant with giving people a truckload of time for a minor crime. We have 144 people right now that have been exonerated from death row, including myself. We were sitting there waiting, ready to die, and for some reason, they found out that we were innocent. Now, the courts never did this. It wasn't the justice system. It was always an outside force, somebody fighting for us, that found that we were innocent. No, we're not the best justice system in the world at all.
So, Ron, Ethel has something she wants to say to you on that one.
Ron, I said that, but it was meant sarcastically. And to our audience out there, listening audience, that was sarcasm, okay? I totally agree with you.
She was just trying to get a reaction out of you there, Ron.
Hey, and if it made you jump up out of your chair, I mean.
and turn up the volume a little bit more.
It's even to the point where we have people in the European countries that are talking about sanctions, injunctions, tariffs against us because of our stance on capital punishment alone. But
yeah,
anyway, let's move on, I guess. That's just something that struck me.
So, Ron, if you would, please, share with our listeners a little bit of your background as far as your story and your case. And then let's talk about, you know, what you're doing with the Witness to Innocence organization.
I was traveling on a road trip with a bunch of my drunken buddies when I was 20s. Through the state of New Mexico, not knowing that a murder had happened about a week before we left on our trip. And they basically framed the whole case against us. They came up with a witness who said she saw us do it. It turned out that they choreographed her entire statement, even to the point they told her how to put an onion in her pocket, rub her fingers on the onion, and then rub her eyes when she's talking to the jury. They taught her how to do all that. Then there was no evidence whatsoever to convict us, nothing. And they tried everything. I mean, that's all the forensics in the world. They had a guy named James T. Weston. He was chief medical examiner, for the state of New Mexico. if that name is familiar to anybody, any historian. He's the one who also did the John F. Kennedy autopsy.
Oh, wow.
Well, during our trial for 2 years, he showed these gory pictures up there on a movie screen. He found the body, this, and this gory thing happened, and this and that and all that. Later on, when we came up for a retrial, he admitted that he never, ever saw the body. He completely lied. Some of the pictures were not even of that crime. And he claimed that he was paid $50,000 by the prosecutor for that testimony against us. He retired right after he confessed. But anyway, we got convicted.
Well, let me ask you this real quick, Ron. Now, he gets paid by the prosecutor. So the prosecutor just, bought a bribe. This man should be contempt of court is the smallest thing that he should have been prosecuted for. Did he spend any time in prison?
You got to understand something in our justice system. No, he didn't. But you got to understand something. The judge, a lot of times, is kind of like a referee in a football game. And it just really feels bad when that referee runs out and sacks the quarterback.
That's what
happens in a court of law many, many times. Even though the prosecutors spent $50,000 for their expert witness, the judge would not give us $625 to bring in a uniformed police officer who had given one of our guys a ticket in California, 600 miles away, when they said the murder was happening. The judge said it wouldn't affect the trial whatsoever. And when you're indigent, that's what you get. You have to go up and ask him for any dime that you get to fight your case, investigation, for anything whatsoever. And he just denies it constantly. Yet the prosecutor has the checkbook, blank checkbook of the state to spend whatever he wants on that trial. It's not fair. There's no way. You get these top prosecutors are fighting lawyers who are fresh out of law school. Ours was fresh out of law school. And it's just not fair. So anyway, nothing happened to that guy whatsoever. You got to understand this, too. All prosecutors and police officers and everything are under a veil of immunity given to them by Scalia, Roberts, Alito, Kennedy. Constantly, we lose these cases. When we go into court, we try to go after a prosecutor. Just recently, prosecutors have been getting called a little bit to answer for what they've done. Other than that, they got immunity. Mine was a rare case. The assistant prosecutor got disbarred, and three detectives got fired. That was extremely, extremely rare. In the 144 cases I know right now of people who are exonerated from death row, I can count six where the prosecutor has absolutely, actually said that he might have made a mistake. And some just say might. They won't say that they did. Pretty rare.
So
nothing,
Ron,
happens to these guys.
I'm reading a little bit more about your case here, and or I read earlier as well that there is or that there were tapes of an interview related to your case, and those tapes just mysteriously disappeared. And on those tapes is where the story was retracted, basically. But the judge
the woman who was testifying against us, she had told several people before that she didn't see anything, that the police are making her say this. She was a self-professed part-time hotel maid and prostitute. I mean, I guess, she was right there, so why not? I don't know what her reasons were, but that's what she professed. And to get her boyfriend out of prison, she said that she would testify, but then she changed her mind several times. Now, one of these were recorded on tape. And during the trial, the judge got mad. He says, there's no way there's any tape like that. I would have known about it. And a reporter held up the tape, said, it's right here, Your Honor. It was immediately the prosecutor demanded that that tape be turned over to him. It was turned over to him, and it was never seen again. He lost it somewhere.
What about chain of custody? I guess that didn't matter.
Chain of custody doesn't work when you say, I don't know what happened to it. I left it on my desk. The murder weapon itself was found in the sheriff's safe. during the confession, the guy who actually did the actual murder, he said he gave the gun to the sheriff, and they actually got a search warrant, opened the sheriff's safe, and found the murder weapon.
And how many years later was
this?
How many years later was that, Ron?
That they found it 2 years later. 2 years later, they found it in his safe, along with the forensic report saying he sent it to the crime lab, and the crime lab said, yes, this was definitely the murder weapon. When the sheriff was asked where he got it, two kids on bicycles turned it in. Well, who were these kids? Well, we don't know their name. So somebody asked the sheriff, these kids found a pistol at a murder scene, and you didn't even get their names? No, we didn't think anything to do with the case. They can say anything they want, and there is nothing you can do about them. They just do it. It's stacked against you. It's not in the United States anymore. It doesn't matter if you killed anybody or not. Whoever has the best lawyer is going to win. I don't care if it's a traffic ticket to a murder to what it is. Best lawyer is going to win. Innocence doesn't mean anything anymore. I believe. This is my opinion.
Hey,
look
I'm right
the court
there
sometime.
Yep, I'm right there with you. I mean, when you can have all these things all the way from the sheriff as a murder weapon and a confession from the actual killer, but they keep you guys in locked up. And how long did you spend?
22 months. We're one of the lucky ones. We spent 22 months. And during that time, quite a bit of that was proving the murder. Actually had to prove that he did it because the prosecutor said he refused to talk to him. He said, no, we got the right guy. Turned out this was a police officer, by the way. The actual murder was a police officer.
So it sounds a little bit like the blue code kind of kicked in there.
You know what? Professional courtesy is if you and I are cops and I catch your son drunk driving at midnight or something, and I don't arrest him, I can't come home and tell you about it. But when it comes to covering up and framing other people for murder, putting them on death row to kill them when you know they're innocent, that goes a little bit beyond the call.
Oh, that's, something is absolutely wrong with that. And you know, Ron, we have a saying here that we use all the time. We're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So we know that there are some upstanding law enforcement professionals out there. But when you hear stories like this and then when you see the corruption in the courtroom, in your situation, in other situations, in the IRP6 case, where, like, we were just talking to Larry Severance and we were explaining some of the things that went on with Judge
right.
Christine Arceo and the jury and so forth, and Larry's comment being that, well, it sounds like something was going on there. Absolutely,
yeah.
Something was going on there, you know? And in your situation, Larry, I mean, obviously you and your partners, you guys were probably trying to figure out, man, we're just out for a motorcycle ride.
Exactly.
You know, what is going on?
And to be on, you know, find out your innocence. I mean, for them to finally, you know, say you're innocent 9 days before you're executed. Is that what I read here?
Yeah, that wasn't any fun. It got us a little nervous.
I would think.
Yeah.
And so Ron,
but what can you do about it? Every single thing that you do, you're on death row. When you eat, when you wake up, when you drink, anything that you want to do down there, even brush your teeth, is when they tell you to do it. And you're sitting there being told what to do all the time by these people who you know want to kill you because they keep telling you all the time. Even the guards, they wanted us to own our crime, to fess up to what we did and show remorse and all that. And how do you do that when you didn't do anything?
Yeah.
Even
understood.
In the courtroom, they say they showed no remorse.
Right, because you didn't do anything.
I don't have anything to be remorseful about. But Ron, we understand that you were at the Innocence Project get-together there in Portland recently.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, the last weekend. It was great. A lot of work. We did so many of these workshops and the panel discussions and everything. I mean, it was just incredible to just try to take it all in. I'm still going over my notes.
And so in your work with the Witness to Innocence, what do you have going on there? And by the way, we got to give a shout out to David Love, the executive director of Witness to Innocence.
Yeah.
David was on our program a little while back.
David is no longer with us.
Is that right?
Yeah, just recently. He's moved on.
Well, David is doing a great work, you know, and I know that he, you know, his heart is with this kind of effort and so what are you doing with the Witness to Innocence Project right now?
Well, my job classification is basically I deal with the members. I'm kind of like the buffer between staff and board and members, although, you know, our staff and board are members also, some of them. And I kind of help people out, you know, when they got problems, they call me and stuff, and I just keep in contact with them. But I do other things, too. I write part of the newsletter. I love to write. There's a new law book out now on wrongful convictions that's being studied in law schools all over the United States. I wrote a chapter in that. I've been published in about 7 countries, just writing things on law and wrongful convictions on death row and from the exoneree standpoint. And do a lot of speaking. Go to a lot of law schools and colleges and churches and go on tours telling everybody what happened to us. What we want to do is put a face on the death penalty. Human face. This is me. I could be your uncle, your cousin, your brother. This is me. This happened.
Yeah. And you know, Ron, we always, and we just said it again tonight on the program, that we are trying to bring more awareness and open folks' eyes to this, to the wrongful convicted, the wrongful incarcerated, those who are sitting on death row, who didn't commit any crimes. And so, you know, we applaud you for doing the work that you're doing, and want to just say, you know, just continue in the fight. We will. And so this is Ron Kine. He's with the Witness to Innocence organization. Ron is for our part of our profile of the wrongfully convicted.
And you know what? I was just looking at this real quick. You said here, if you have ethics and they are for sale, you don't have ethics. I can't stop the death penalty, but we can. And that is awesome. We sure can.
Yes, and we're going to do it. We get more and more people. We're winning one state every year, and we're going to knock them down. We're going to make our government stop killing its own citizens.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, Ron, well, thanks
for joining. My brother Ray Crone, another death row exoneree, puts it this way. When you see wrong, when you see social injustice, you don't have to stand tall, but by golly, you've got to stand up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, Ron, again, thanks for joining us this evening. That is Ron Kine for our profile of the wrongfully convicted, and taking a little bit of time out to spend with us to share his story and just bring more awareness to this corruption that's in our system. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. We're on the downside of this. When we come back, we'll kind of start to wrap things up. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Ethel Lopez and Cliff Stewart. We're on the downside. Got a few minutes here. We're going to start to wrap things up. We had a full program this evening and covered a lot of different subjects and was able to touch on the IRP 6 case reflect upon the program from the other night, where we had Judge Sarakin on along with Attorney Darren Kavanoki, and played a clip from there. Folks can go out to ajcradio.com and listen to the archive of that program and then also tonight's program. But, you know, a lot of what we talk about goes back to things that happened during the IRP6 case. And the main point that we're fighting right now, that being the over 200 pages of transcript that's missing. And the lawsuit that we have going with that, and the attorney, Mark Garagos, and team and company, along with Gwendolyn Solomon and Tina Glandian, you know, everyone's putting forth a great effort on this. And so, you know, there's a lot of good work going on there. But from a Just Cause perspective, some of the other things that we're doing, we have the petition out there at change.org. We ask that you go out there, do a search on IRP6, sign that petition. And then, Ethel, we always put out a call to action. Do
yes,
something else.
We do. We always want our listeners to please pick up the phone and have your family and friends pick it up as well and call Attorney General Eric Holder's office. His number is 202-514-2003 and 2005, and ask him, what are you doing about the over 200 pages of missing transcript in the IRP 6 case? You know, these men have been sitting in prison now over 21 months. They have families. They want to come home. These are innocent men. What are you doing about this? That's 202-514-2003 and 2005.
And, you know, Mark Garagos said that in his over 31 years of practice, he's never, ever seen anything like this.
Yes.
We had Sidney Powell on, a well-known appellate attorney from Dallas, Texas. What did she say? How many cases has she, appellate cases
over
has she?
Over 500,
yeah.
And she said it's, the word she used was bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
And then Judge Lee Sarakin, he said it's baffling.
Mm-hmm.
Darren Kavanoki, he said it's inconceivable. So every time we tell anybody
Absolutely.
About this craziness that's going on with these over 200 pages of transcript that's missing,
yeah,
they have these words of this. It's inexplicable why they're missing, why the judge won't bring them to fruition. And just like Judge H. Lee Sarakin said, he said it is inconceivable that those records do not exist. If the court reporter did not type them in, the audio recording picked them up.
That's
there
right.
is a backup. They exist. Judge Arguello, just
but
let
you
it
know
go.
What?
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
They use all those words equal to there's some dirty crap going on in the Tenth Circuit with Judge Christine Arguello and Matthew Kirsch, prosecutor.
That's what it is.
That's the bottom line.
And that's why, you know, we every show we have, we say to the jurors, look, if all these people with all this experience is saying that there's baffling, inconceivable, bizarre, never, ever been seen before things that happened
exactly.
in this case, you have a right to have questions. And that is why we cannot blame it on you, what happened during that trial. The blame is on Judge Christine Arguello. If you have questions and anything about anything that happened,
mm-hmm.
give us a call. We will let you know any information that we have. We will give you any documentation that
yes.
we have. Like I said, we have everything.
Everything.
But the missing transcript.
That's
so
it.
Reach us at area code 855-529-4252 or reach us via email on contact@a-justcause.com.
And, you know, Cliff, they don't even have to wait to call us on that.
Don't
I mean,
wait.
We have the website that's set up at freetheirp6.org.
Right.
Freetheirp6, that's the number 6.org. There is a lot of information out there that you can begin to just kind of comb through it. You know, do some word searches on Fifth Amendment violation. Do some word searches. Just put in the number 200.
Hey,
all right.
Hey, I mean, Judge Christine Arguello had a conversation between her and Darlene Martinez where the judge was asking, you know, how many pages are we talking about? This is when the guys at the IRP 6 were asking for the transcript.
Right,
right,
right.
And Judge Arguello said, you know, asked Martinez, how many pages are we talking about? She says, over 200 pages. And the judge says, I see no reason, but, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I don't see any reason to give that to the defendants right now, and I'm not going to expedite their request. And so, you know, in other words, let's move on.
Yeah, she meant I wasn't giving them to them right now. I'm not going to give them to them later. I'm not going to give them to them at any time.
Exactly. I mean, the justice system is not about a person should have to fight for
a
transcript. I mean, like that clip said, you know, from Judge Sarakin and Mr. Kavanoki. It's like it's supposed to be about fairness. You know, the judge and the judge's team is not supposed to be about advocating one side versus the other.
That's
and
right.
you say it all the time, Cliff. The judge is supposed to be a referee.
A referee.
That did not happen in the IRP 6 case. So at any rate, if you'd like more information about it, Just Cause, you can go out to www.a-justcause.com. www.a-justcause.com. We would really appreciate it if you click the donate button as well. And if you'd like programming information, go to ajcradio.com. If you'd like a little bit more programming, you can go to Live 365. Also, starting on April 20th from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time, we become part of the Progressive Radio Network. That's PRN.FM. Cliff.
Yeah, I want to say thank you to everyone in the chat room for all of your comments. I want to say thank you to our guests, Lisa Bloom, Larry Severance, and Ron Kine. Thank you for joining us tonight. Also, we want to say thank you to our crew, K&D Productions, Captain Kyle, Dustin Jackson, helping out in the control room. If it wasn't for them, you would not hear us. Also, to our production support team, they give us the material that we need to present to you. They do a great job with their research and making sure we have everything that we need. And to the truth, we know you're out there, and we appreciate it.
That's right. And to all the members of A Just Cause, we thank you for your support. Keep on keeping on.
And Olivia?
Of course, Olivia.
And
we got you,
and
Olivia.
And Ms. Barbara.
And Ms. Barbara.
And, you know, all the folks that are out there on Twitter and Facebook, we appreciate you pushing our message. I mean, it's all the way, you know, it's international. And we got support all over the world on this thing. And so we appreciate all the partnerships around the world. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. And, you know, we appreciate you tuning in every Tuesday and Thursday right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and that's 6 to 8 p.m. Mountain Time. So, you know, the IRP6, Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, keep them in your prayers. Keep their families in your prayers.
Yeah.
Go out and check out that press release from Kia Banks and the IRP6. That's the daughter of David Banks. You will be impressed. This morning, that press release went over 120,000.
Wow.
I mean, that's a pretty compelling. This is Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you educational awareness and information about judicial injustice. Join us next time. Good night, America.
Good night, y'all.